As a monk, we should be some of the hardest people in the world to offend. You have to do quite a lot to offend a monk. Just for our tolerance and kindness. So anyway, we can actually start this evening's talk. And again, I'm looking if there's anyone's... No t-shirts today. Because last week... I didn't know what I was going to talk about. I saw someone had a t-shirt which was, what was it, Awesome Infinity or something. Infinite Wonder. There's no t-shirts today. So never mind. But what I will talk about is this, why do people come here? It always amazes me. On a Friday evening, you've got so many other things you could do. Stay at home. Put your feet up, have something to eat, just watch the TV. There must be nothing on TVs on Friday afternoons or Friday evenings. But why? It's the same that so often, if any of you come to our monasteries, certainly I know the one where I live, there's so many people come every day to feed the monks. And there's more people than is what we need to eat. There's so much food there every day. Of course, nothing gets wasted. For those of you who don't know that anything which is left over, we have a chicken farm just down the road. So the chicken farms get the leftovers, and they're very happy. There's so many monks there. But anyway, but a lot of times I ask people, what? They don't get paid to go there. They don't get forced to go there. And many of you have been there. Why? Do you like going to like a monastery? You know, spend a couple of hours there, or even longer, to offer dana, offer this food. And it's not necessary, but you do it. And the reason why that people kept telling me, and I knew the answer, but I wanted to ask them so I could actually say it. I did actually ask, this is why they go there. And they go there for happiness, just to be happy. Not to get merit or to do a service for their deceased grandmother or something. They do it because they feel good. There's a sense of inner happiness, something very simple and joyful about being with really kind, good people who don't ask you for anything, who don't sort of expect anything out of you, who just can be your friends for half an hour, 2 hours or whatever. It's something very beautiful about doing something where there's nothing to be gained, nothing to be lost, just spending time together. So many things we do in life. You know, a few times I've had to go into shopping malls to get some lunch or something, and everything is just calling at you, buy me, do something. You go to other places, you know, in the world, there's always so many rules and regulations, how fast you can go, how slow you can go. Because now we've got this double demerit time. And I always mention this to keep this in mind. If it's double demerits time, it also means you have to be the opposite. They all go together. It's double merits when you do good things. Double rewards of kindness and joy and happiness. I don't know why people don't get that. But why then somebody needs something, you just don't just give it to them because, you know, you have it. There's such simple things. That just what popped into my mind there was in those days when you could go traveling on aircraft, I remember being in transit in Singapore airport, and I was just passing, and this poor woman was trying to get a few hours sleep between flights, just, you know, on one of those benches, and she was tossing and turning, moving, trying to find a comfortable space. And I know how hard it must be with all that noise and all that movement and light. And one thing I had one of these eye shades which you can put over your eyes. So it's a simple thought. I took the eye shade out of my bag and I just gave it here. This might help. And you know, the smile on that woman's face, I can remember. Just a simple act of kindness. Just, I had an eye shade and why not give it to them? And so you did that. And that was just, for me it was nothing. For her it meant she could get a bit of sleep. but also meant this beautiful act of joy and happiness. And that's one of the reasons why, hopefully, that people come to places like this. Simple encouraging people to be kind to one another, to look after one another. And those tiny, tiny acts of kindness, they mean a lot. Because the reason is because we live in a world which is so materialistic, which is all about me. And over here, it's not about me at all. It's how can I help and serve somebody else? And sometimes I get into criticized like that when people tell me, Ajahn Brahm, you're doing too much. Ajahn Brahm, you shouldn't just do all of these things. No, it's a pleasure and joy to see if you can serve and help. I'm supposed to be a senior monk now. If I was in other traditions, you'd have to serve me. You're the great pope of Serpentine. But no, it's just much more fun just looking after others. And that's one of the problems there, that if ever you get sort of well known and the boss of a company or something, it must be terrible to be a boss of a company. One of the reasons why I try my hardest to be incognito very often. And so sometimes to actually go around and not let on who you are, or what you are, or what's going on. And I still remember with so much joy and happiness, playing a trick when I was in South Korea on this young, poor South Korean monk at a conference. And at a conference, you're usually presenting a lot of times, but every now and again, you listen to other people present, other people teach. And I remember that time that someone else was giving a talk, so I sat in the auditorium around the back. And was sitting next to this Sri Lankan monk, came to sit next to me, I think, just so he could practice his English, as they do. And so he's a young monk, and he said, "Now, who are you?" And I said, "Oh, I'm a monk, I'm from Australia." "Oh, from Australia," he said. And he said, next thing he said, this is no exaggeration, he said, "Oh, you're from Australia, do you know a monk there called Ajahn Brahm? He's quite well known in South Korea." And I said, "Yes, I know him very well." And I said, "I am Ajahn Brahm." "Ah!" That's what he did. He did a little scream there. I shouldn't have done that, but I enjoyed that because, what's the difference between just being a friendly monk and just being someone well known? I don't know. But anyway, just you enjoy the happiness and joy which you can give to people just by being kind. And I think that's something which, in this organisation of Buddhist Society of West Australia, we try and convey. We're not just teaching theories. That many people here, monks, nuns, lay people, we've been living these teachings for so many years. And it has an effect on you. It has an effect on not being proud. Being proud and egotistical, that's something which is totally foreign from the teachings of Buddhism. I'd mentioned that story about me going incognito and surprising that poor young Sri Lankan monk. But I also remember that's a story in the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha went to walking by himself very often. And there was another monk who was actually coming from the west coast of India to meet the Buddha. He never met the Buddha before. He was ordained by one of the Buddha's disciples. So he was traveling and he came to a place just overnight, always walking in those days. Came to a place and asked this Buddhist potter or whatever it was, "Okay, if I can sleep in your workshop overnight, had straw in it." "Yeah, sure you can." And then another monk came, "Okay, if I can sleep here as well." "Yeah, sure you can, as long as the first monk who came here agreed." So the first monk said, "Yeah, okay, no trouble." And of course, being monks, they started meditating. And the two monks were meditating together, and they were just really good meditators. And the two of them, they meditated all night together. And in the morning, they had to open their eyes, come out of meditation to go on their arms around and get something to eat. And the first monk who came there, the second monk who came there said, "Oh, you're a very good meditator. Who's your teacher?" He said, "Oh, my teacher is from the west coast of India. And he's a disciple of the Buddha. And I'm just traveling to meet the Buddha. And so the monk said, well, who's your teacher? And the monk who came secondly said, I don't have a teacher. I am the Buddha. Ah! And so to me, that story is a wonderful sense of like a bit of humility as well. You don't just show off, you know, because you're the Buddha. You just have that kindness. And even that humility and respect. Oh, you came here first. It's okay if I share this place with you. But some of those little softness of humanity are very important, you know, even in this place over here. So just because you're the president of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, where's he gone now? It's like, what is this? It's in the back. He doesn't have his president's chair at the front somewhere. So it's nice to have that sort of humility where everybody is respected and treated, you know, with that sort of kindness. But not just treating other people with that kindness, also treating oneself with that kindness. It's the other thing which I really liked about the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. It's not just what you can do for us. It's what we can do for us. I always make this up as I go along. What we can do for us. In other words, it's not about one person giving to another person. This is a wonderful sharing. What's in the best interest of the whole of our community? And of course, that comes from that lovely little teaching about, you know, when people are getting married. The whole idea about relationships. Because the Buddhist Society of Western Australia is a relationship between all the people who come here, all the people who support the place, all the people who listen over online. You know, people who just haven't been able to come here for 2 years because they've been in Darwin all that time. But they've still connected with us online. The lady in the front here. And she's been so far away for so many years, I think it's right that you come closest to us tonight. But anyway, just why? And that little story I said about relationships is important because it's fundamental to our life. We always live with other people, we meet other people, we go to work, we go on the bus with somebody else. There's so many times that we're with somebody else. And that time when after a wedding, I'd always make the opportunity to look at the bride and say, now you're a married woman. From this day on, you must not think of yourself. And then look at the husband and say, you're a married man now. You can't think of yourself anymore. And they both agree on that. And the next line, which I'm sure you all remember, was the most important one. It said, now you're married, you must not think of your partner. Never. Don't think of your wife, don't think of your husband anymore. From now on, only think of us. You're in it together. I don't know why people don't get that third option. That, you know, when you're in a family, it's not about me, it's not about her, not about him. It's always about us. We're in it together. Same as this Buddhist Society of Western Australia. One of the things which I'm very, you might say, proud of, very happy with, that this is a very rare Buddhist society, which is not Sri Lankan Buddhist society. It's not a Thai Buddhist society. It's not a Russian Buddhist society. It's not a Darwin Buddhist society. Everybody is involved. Sometimes I joke, we're so desperate we'd accept anybody. We've got that Indonesian, Vietnamese, goodness knows, I'm sure I've left out quite a few, Greek. But what's nice about it is that it's about us. We live in this beautiful world, and it doesn't matter who you are, you're most welcome to come here and get whatever you can, even Muslims. You know that this Muslim girl, once she came on one of my retreats, 9-day retreat. And I was really, because she came in the hijab, you know, the full gear, and she'd actually booked in for a meditation retreat, and I said, is it okay, you come? I said, yeah, I booked in. So she came in, and she was very observant. So when she actually came in, then she took off her hijab. Because apparently, according to their religious rules, they have to wear it outside, but when they're in the religious place, then they can take it off. And she meditated for 9 days and gave all the interviews, and at the end, so I asked her, how was it? And she said, oh, this is wonderful. There's nothing wrong with this. How can there be anything wrong for any religion when it creates peace and happiness? You don't have to commit to anything. You don't have to change your religion. You don't have to give any donations. It's all done for free. And it's something beautiful and peaceful and breaking down barriers between people so they can actually come and be welcomed and feel that beautiful sense that no one is asking anything from them at all. We're just going to share our days together in kindness and in peace. And even like in peace, in a meditation retreat, that's what we're developing, peace. We're not developing ability to sit still for many hours and see who sat for the most hours in meditation. That's crazy. I must admit that when I first did meditation retreats, that's what I did. I remember this absolutely stupid Ajahn Brahm. But you know that I made a resolution, you know, the tough guy type resolution, that I am going to be the last person out of the meditation hall every evening for the 9-day retreat. That's what I should do. So you know what happened? You know, after everybody had left, I thought everyone had left, I'd open one eye. And there's still a couple of people still sitting there. Who do they think they are? You close your eye and sit there a bit longer. And then one to get up and leave. There's still one left. Come on. That's actually ridiculous. My legs were killing me. My back was hurting. Getting no meditation. I was just trying to, you know, keep my record and be the toughest monk. I wasn't the toughest monk. I didn't win that award. I won the stupidest monk award. So a lot of times, instead of having that who's the best and who's the proudest, just we have who's the most peaceful. And when you think of what's most peaceful, it does actually change the whole structure of what we're doing here. Is this making you peaceful? Is this making you agitated? And if it makes you agitated, it's going in the wrong direction. But, I was told by my teacher I've got to watch my breathing. You don't need to watch your breathing. You know, there's so many hours every night when I fall asleep I don't watch my breathing. But my breathing does keep on going on quite okay without me. I don't always have to watch it. It may be a naughty child, you think you always have to watch it. But you know, sometimes you leave your child alone and the child reacts perfectly. And brings up that story. Why are we always like control freaks? Why do we want to be the best? No, not sort of show up our faults. And that lovely story, because you teach meditation to so many different people in our world. And this was in our little local group down in Armidale. And there you've got low socio-economic area. And you get, you know, women, sometimes single women, sometimes women struggling with families. And of course, because they're struggling, they have to work very hard and just, they get very tired. And there's one woman over there, there's one mother, she told me this lovely story. That she always wanted to meditate. But as soon as she sat down in her little apartment or flat, whatever you call it, that her two kids would say, Mummy, 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 I need to go to the toilet. Mummy, 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 I need a glass of water. And of course they didn't need to go to the toilet, they didn't need to have a glass of water, they just needed attention from their poor mummy. And so she was always having to do something for her two kids. And they never gave her any rest to do any meditation, but she tried. She'd get a little cushion and sit down there. Mummy, Mummy, I need to go to potty. Mummy, Mummy. And so she ignored them. So then they actually started crawling over her and pulling her long hair. Mummy, Mummy, Mummy. And she would move. But then she told me one day she'd had enough of this. So she decided she was going to meditate. So she sat down in a room somewhere, nice cushion, closed her eyes. And the usual techniques came up from her two kids. Mummy, 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 I need to go to the toilet. Mummy, Mummy, I need a glass of water. She didn't move. Then he started crawling over her, pulling her. Mummy, Mummy, I really need to go. She wouldn't move. So never underestimate the innovative abilities of young children. They're just amazing, just what they can think of. So they said, "Mummy, Mummy, Mummy, Simon has got the sharp knife out of the kitchen cabinet. Mummy, 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 Sarah has turned on the gas." It's amazing just the kids could think of that. But Mummy was up to the challenge. So she just sat there. And she said to me that she thought that if the kids blew up the house or they carved each other to bits, so be it. I'm meditating. And when she came out of meditation, the kids were playing quietly in the corner. The sharp kitchen knife was still in the drawer. The gas hadn't been turned on. She'd called their bluff, and she won. And she said, from that day on, whenever she wanted to meditate, she'd just sit down and the kids said, "Oh, Mummy's meditating, nothing we could do." And she trusted them, and they always played quietly together while she was meditating. It's a wonderful thing that, you know, she'd given so much to her kids. But now the kids realize it's time to give to the Mummy, give her a space. And the other thing which happened was that after meditating for half an hour, Mummy was such a nice Mummy. The kids actually just enjoyed that. And often would say, "Mummy, Mummy, please go and meditate. You're getting a bit cranky." And that lovely, fun, joy of meditating, not to become enlightened. Or is it part of the enlightenment? Learning how to be in peace and harmony with the people you actually live with and yourself. There's a lot to say about that. But it's also just learning, just this beautiful peace and happiness. And it's happiness which is built out of this, what we call in Buddhism, the skillful means. Just know how, you know, through kindness, through generosity, but sometimes just doing kindness for no reason whatsoever, just because you can do it. To be able to bend your legs or sit on a chair, if in case you're getting old, Peter. There's chairs around the back there. So don't torture yourself. Or if you want to, please, you can sit with your legs out. I know that sometimes people say, "No, Ajahn Brahm, you're not supposed to point your feet at a Buddha." And that's one of our little rules. It's kept so strictly in Thailand, you're not supposed to point your feet at a Buddha. But look, in this place, there's Buddhas all over the place. Whichever way you point them, you're going to point them at a Buddha somewhere. There's one over there, there's one in that room over there, there's one in the room over there, and many behind me. So whichever way you point your feet, they're going to be pointed at the Buddha somewhere. So just relax and enjoy out of kindness. So little by little we learn just about why we come here is, again, because people are respected. And you're kind to people. And we don't judge. That's one of those other little stories when it's all about us, not about me. I said, how can you judge? If you're judging, you're just judging us. You're not judging this person or that person. And of course that was, to make the introduction to this little anecdote, that time when I used to spend a lot of many days teaching in prisons. And it was one of those nice compliments which I got, one of the best compliments I've ever got from a prison officer who called up Burning the Island Monastery. And eventually got through to me. He said, "Oh, great. Ajahn Brahm, please come back to teach at the prison." I was in the prison in Canning Vale. "Please come back to teach." He said, "I'm too busy. I'll send another monk." "No, we want you." And of course, what's the next question you ask? Why me? And then he gave me this wonderful compliment. He said that he'd been in the prison service for all his career. And in that one jail in particular, in Canning Vale. And he said he noticed something unique. That every prisoner, every one of them which came to my classes, when they were released at the end of their sentence, they never ever got back into jail again. Zero recidivism. There's all types of crimes which those people had done. But he said that was so unique. And this was from a prison officer. He wasn't a Buddhist. But it's just what he noticed. He said, "Please, please come back." And I sort of afterwards, why? You just go there to teach and just do your very best, like I come here of an evening to teach, try and do my best. Why? And that really started to open my mind up to why the Buddhist Society of West Australia is very successful. Why Bodhinyana Monastery and the other monasteries? Why in a place like Perth? You know, honestly, people in Sydney and Melbourne, they can't believe what's happening here. I remember this friend of mine, he was a Tibetan from Melbourne, and I invited him over here just to see what the Buddhist Society of West Australia was. And he turned the corner, I remember being in the car with him. First of all, going to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery. Wow, this is a big monastery. Where did this come from? He said, we built it. And as you all know, built it with your own hands. And turn the corner of Nansen Way and see this place on a Friday night, and all the people here. So, wow, this is amazing. Because I always thought that, you know, Perth was the backwater. And he couldn't believe it. So why? And of course, it's not the money. It's not the sort of the facilities. It's just the kindness and the respect which is given to people and the welcome and not asking anything from you. It was this call which I got before one of the talks one evening here. This woman rang up and she said, I hear you're giving a talk tonight. I said, yeah, I'm giving a talk. And the conversation, I think this is pretty accurate to what was said. Now, of course, you know, sometimes one word here, one word there sort of disappears. But this is pretty accurate. She said, how much do you charge? I said, nothing. You know that. So no, she said, how much money do you have to pay when you go in the door? I said, zero, nothing. No, you don't understand, she said. She got very irate. How many dollars, cents do you have to pay to get in the door? And I said, madam, you pay nothing to come in. No one asks you for anything. They don't take your name. You don't have to pay to get out. It's all for free. And then I remember her pausing, this beautiful pause, where it actually sunk in what was going on. She said, well, what do you get out of it then? Oh no, what do you guys get out of it, she said. And I said, happiness. Oh. It was actually seeing something in a totally different way. That, you know, this is our Buddhist Society of West Australia giving. You go on retreats, how much does it cost? Nothing. It's all done by donations. If you don't want to, can't pay, you don't pay. That's it. So this is a beautiful way. We're doing this for a totally different reason. Not part of the materialist world, but part of the kindness world. And when you make that very important, that we're doing this as a service, and monks and nuns do this as a service, as an example to others, so you can give your service as well, whichever way you can. Whether it's like volunteering to help with the gardening, or whether it's just coming to help put the chairs away, or just being a kind friend to the person sitting next to you you've never met before, or just cuddling a little kiddie in the back there who you bear no relation to at all in the back, right? That's wonderful. Look, they're so happy in the back there. Dexter and the teddy bear and Ray. Wonderful. So that kindness and joy, that is what this place is all about. Yeah, we may have the deeper teachings. Actually, no. Why did I call them deeper teachings? Because sometimes we think the theory is more important than the practice. All the theories of Eightfold Path and Dependent Origination, all the other stuff about the, you know, nature of existence, it's how that plays out in people's lives is most important. I've seen this too often in some other temples, fortunately not in this place, when people actually, they keep five precepts. Everyone has to keep five precepts. Not killing, not stealing, committing adultery, lying, or taking alcohol or drugs. And even as they're taking those five precepts, you see them. warning the mosquito. Or sneaking off around the back at WASAC time, opening up the boot of their car and taking a swig of whiskey. What are they doing that for? There's something which is, that is like religion, that is not like spirituality, kindness. I remember was a little bit of stories that when I was in Thailand, there was one gentleman, he was a local, he was an alcoholic. And you know, he's trying his very best to overcome that addiction to alcohol. And when it came to, you know, the rains retreat we have, 3 months every year, in the, usually July to October, he came up to myself and a couple of the other senior monks. He wanted to make a resolution, a determination, that during the rains retreat he would not drink any alcohol from sunrise to sunset every day. Don't laugh at the poor fellow, because you know that was incredibly hard for him. He'd have to get up very, very early to get enough alcohol in before the sun came up. And he would hang out, come on son, get down, faster, so he could take another swig. But he did it for 3 months. And I always remember, and I said, what a wonderful thing that was you did. You know, and please feel good about that. I didn't know too much what I was doing at the time, but I realized from now that giving people that sense of self-confidence, well done, you've done something which was for him, was a very, very hard thing to do. Maybe for you it's nothing, but for him that was a wonderful achievement. And we really praised him and just told everybody what a great person that was to be able to resist it like that and just to groan in the Dhamma. So a lot of times that's also that we don't ever expect anyone to be perfect in this place. And of course, you know, because I have to make sure that I practice whatever I teach people. That's why I'm not perfect. Actually, I am perfect, but I pretend not to be, so I can keep my teachings correct. Is that right? I made this wonderful, the 70% rule, which I haven't said for a while. The 70% rule, I got that from when I was a school teacher. Because I had to set an exam. You know the exams you have to set these poor kids. And quite frankly, I really don't like setting exams for anybody. For many reasons. How can you judge a kid? And see, some of those kids who set them exams, there was one kid I remember, I was teaching them maths, and he came bottom of the class the year before. You know, you check from the other teachers. He's in my class, bottom of the class, couldn't do maths. And so, you always got that rebellious spirit in you. And please, you have that rebellious spirit in you as well. And don't sort of abandon it. Just challenge. But please don't challenge me, because sometimes after the talk I get a bit tired. No, of course you can. But I thought, is it because a kid can't do maths? Or is it just his perception? So let's try and change it. So, because I was teaching maybe 2 or 3 classes a week in maths to this particular class, that I gave him extra attention after every class. Actually, during the class, you'd go up to him, you know, when he's setting little problems. Do you understand that? Is that clear to you? And any time he got it right, yeah, well done. I just gave him extra attention more than anyone else in that class. And this is no exaggeration. He came top that year. He came from the bottom to the top. It was unfair, because I should have been able to give that degree of attention to all the kids in the class, but I decided just to focus on this kid, to prove to myself more than anyone else, is it a case you just can't do something, or is it a case that you believe that and that's what stops you? And of course it was that second thing, because you believe you can't, then you don't. So he became really good at maths. But anyway, when he did the exams, I had to set the exams, and again, I don't like exams. One of the things I mentioned to someone even today, when I did exams, I was already a Buddhist, and so I was compassionate. So if your friend, your best friend was sitting next to you, they didn't know the answer, here's the answer. Isn't that like compassion? I said, that's cheating. I said, it's not cheating, it's kindness. I said, no, that's wrong. I really didn't like that. So anyway, but I had to set an exam. So how do you do it? What should you do? And the teacher gave this wonderful piece of advice, which I extended. They said, if you give any exam, never make it too tough. If it's too tough, then you find out the kids afterwards say, I'm terrible at this. I can't do maths because the average score was only 30% or something. Don't make it too easy, otherwise it's a waste of time doing the exam. But try and aim for 70% success. The average score of the whole class, 70%. If you get 70%, you know, people think they can do it. Yeah, they're okay at maths, 70% is not bad. And the most important part, the 30% where people make mistakes, that is where I, as their teacher, can get some feedback. Well, they hadn't understood yet. I thought I taught it to them, but they hadn't really got it yet. So the 30% was a place of growth, of learning. 70% was encouragement. And of course I thought, yeah, that's just life. If you always get 100% in life, 100% in every meditation you sit, 100 meditation to every meal you cook your husband, that's not life, that's not being married. If your wife, if your husband is only 70%, that's the best. If they're 50% or 100%, dump them. The 70% rule is a beautiful rule. It means that you respect people, you don't expect perfection, you respect people, and you learn and grow together. The Buddhist Society of West Australia, we grow, we learn. From the 30% we make mistakes, but the 70% is really good, and we go for this kindness and fun. It is encouraging people, but never expecting perfection. It'll be really tough. Have you ever met a perfect person? They're a pain in the butt. They are. I still remember this person. I couldn't really believe it at the time, but they were one of the first couple of people who come regularly to Bodhinyana Monastery. And then he divorced his wife. So what did he divorce her for? You know, she was just so good. He said, yeah, that's a problem. That's why I divorced her. She was a perfect wife. And it made me feel not up to her. That's actually what he said to me. It's really weird, isn't it? But the reality is that, you know, that there's no one in this world who's perfect, and life isn't perfect. It's the human race. This is our world. We'll improve it. We'll never reach that perfection. But what we can always do, you can't always cure the problems in the world. You can't always cure the problems in your arm. But you can always care for it. And that is a summation of what Buddhism is all about. Not curing yourself or curing your partner, but for caring for them. Not even curing your meditation and all the wandering mind and the stupid thoughts and the other stuff which comes up into your mind when you're meditating. Not trying to cure it and get rid of it, but learning how to care for it. And if you develop that caring to your mind, you find that all those things you try to chase away, they diminish by themselves and they just fade away by themselves when you care rather than try and cure things. You even try that in your physical health, aches and pains which you have in your body. If you try and cure those aches and pains, sometimes it's just too much negativity, too much I don't like this, I don't want this, get out of there. If you try and cure people who you don't like, it's the same attitude. Again, you're trying to get rid of them. Have you ever felt the person was trying to get rid of you? They didn't like you. You couldn't understand why. Did that make you any better? But if people try to care for you, it's something you can always do. That actually works. If you care for somebody else, they'll always be kind back to you. This is one of the great sort of teachings, that caring is actually, strangely, you're not really deliberately trying to cure something, but the caring actually does create the causes for health, happiness and growth to occur. So that's all the time I meditate, just being honest and straightforward to you. Sometimes I'm tired and sleepy. Sometimes I have many thoughts go in the mind at the beginning. But I never ever try and discipline my mind. The idea of disciplining it is just too harsh. Instead, I care for my mind. Really care for it. Oh, poor mind. You're tired because you've been working too much. No, you're wandering because you've had to deal with so many different problems in the last few minutes. So it's okay. Poor mind. It's okay. And sometimes I actually do that. I just stroke my head. That's okay. And when you give that care, you know, you find just the mind starts to become peaceful. Your mind starts to like you. And I've found that this basic should be an obvious truth. The only reason why people think too much is because they're trying to escape from something. And if you're happy being here, you find you don't want to think at all. All the things which you really enjoy, whether it's watching a sunset, going to the beach and watching the waves come in and go out, whether it's listening to great music, all those times, you ever noticed, if you're listening to great music, like classical music, you don't think. You don't have any concepts or inner conversation going on, because the music just fills all the spaces of the mind. When you're happy, you're silent. When you care for this moment, that happiness comes and the silence just is all there. You care for this mind. And then it becomes very peaceful. That's how you meditate. Too many people always say, oh, you've got to discipline your mind, train your mind. How many of you have been training your mind for years? A few people are laughing and know why. It doesn't work. But being kind to your mind. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That works, and the mind gets so incredibly peaceful, so beautiful, so joyful, so happy, so healthy. So you make peace, be kind, be gentle with all the people who come into this room on a Friday night. All the members or non-members of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. No matter sort of what age, no matter what race, gender, LGBTQIA+, all very welcome. And any physical impairments, you're most welcome. In other words, that caring for as many possible people as possible. That is, I think, the strength of our monasteries and of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Just built on something which is truly spiritual. And never forgetting that we are here not to create more Buddhists. We're here to create more kindness. We're here to emphasize caring than curing the world's problems. But we're caring for them. And then the problems vanish by themselves. And in families, just not expecting perfection, but 70%. And when you see something wrong, that's wonderful, that's where you're learning together. A new way of accepting the person you met is not perfect. And that you are not perfect. So I often say, I've never seen a couple where the husband and the wife are totally perfect. That's why they're always a good match. At which point I think I'm going to stop rabbiting on and open it up for any questions. Okay, so around the back, any questions? Oh, that's 50 minutes going on. Sadhu, okay. So any questions from the back? Okay. Wow, it's a very slow walk. Very good. Calm me down. Thank you. That's the other thing we used to do in meditation retreats. You ever seen people doing the slow walking meditation? I've done that before. See if I can be the slowest in walking meditation. It's crazy what you do. Anyway, we have one from Germany. How do I handle oversensitivity when everything is very intense or even the slightest sadness or joy of others makes me cry immediately? What do you do? Just cry. Trying to suppress that, deny its existence of how you feel. Sometimes that will just make you more sensitive. So, how to overcome this? For goodness sake, don't worry what other people think of you. Sometimes, how many of you were really concerned on how other people think of you? How you dress? Look at me! I'm dressed like a girl. So instead of what other people think of you, you just be relaxed and at peace. The slightest sadness or joy makes you cry immediately. I still remember that one gentleman, Aussie fellow, about 30, between the 30 and 40, that came on one of the meditation retreats, and one of the first interviews he had with me, he said that he started crying during the meditation. He said, didn't know why. There's no reason or other. And he said, what's wrong? And of course, I never said, what's wrong? I said, it's right. When was the last time you cried? I asked him. And then he fell silent. I'd hit the nail on the head. He said, about 20 years ago. I started crying for some really valid reason. My dad said, Australian men don't cry. I said, said to him, sir, you've got a lot of crying to catch up on. And he did. The whole retreat was crying all the time. When people asked him, I told that story, because that's an important story, I shared it. Oh, he got so much kindness from all the other people, especially the girls. He was single. I'm sure he got many proposals by the retreat. Because he was crying so much and being sensitive. Well, why do people say that you're not allowed to cry? Of course you're allowed to cry. So, oversensitivity, I think the point is, sir, in Germany, you're not oversensitive, you're a human being. And if you start crying, you would encourage other people to also cry and feel free. There are days you just want to laugh, days you want to cry. So just be who you are and try to respect your emotions. And don't try and control them. That's positive emotions, not the... Please control your pathological emotions. From United Arab Emirates. I like to ask, why do monks shave their head and why do they put on robes? Thank you, Ajahn Bum. The reason why I shave my head is because I've got grey hair. The reason I wear a robe is all I've got. It's either this or nothing. I said that. I've been very healthy, but about 22 years ago, I think. Yeah, about a year. No, more than that, 32 years ago. 32 years ago, I got really sick. I'm not sure why. Felt no energy. So one of the doctors here, they just said, I'll give you a checkup. He was working in Rockingham Hospital. It was a long time ago, 30 years ago or something. But the problem was, this is no exaggeration, he was a gynecologist. But he still admitted me. So I remember being in this bed in the men's ward. And they had like, Dr. Mendes, gynecologist. You should have seen. And some of the comments I got from the nurses. This is really weird, but it started even before I was admitted when I turned up at the hospital. And they said, where's your pajamas? So I'm a monk who don't have pajamas. So you have to wear pajamas. I said, it's this or nothing. Take your choice. That's what I said. So they let me wear my robes inside the hospital. Well, it's good enough. So that's all I have. And they do this out of simplicity, and it's also because, look at, you know, all the different hairstyles you have. And we've got to keep it even for the monks and the nuns. So imagine if the nuns had hair. How much would it cost going to the salon every week? Having a different hairstyle. It's so much easier just shaving it all off. This was like 40, how long have I been a monk now? 46 years. 46 years when I first started shaving my hair, that it was really weird. Nowadays it's so popular. You see how monks are trendsetters? And it's only a matter of time you start wearing robes. Maybe, I don't know. But no, it's just, the main reason is because of simplicity. A robe is really easy. You don't have to worry what colour to wear. And it just, you know, goes right over you. You don't have buttons and other stuff. So it feels really good. I like my robe. And of course, my robe is also, it serves many purposes. It is my bed sheet at night time. So I don't need another bed sheet. And it's also, especially those times when I used to go travelling, and they said, when aren't you worried about going on these flights, you know, especially, you know, over the Middle East? Because those couple of flights were actually shot down. So what would you, what happened to you, Ajahn Brahm, if you were shot down in one of those flights going over the Middle East or over Ukraine or something? I said, no worries. Because he's also doubles as a parachute. It's that big. It's 3 meters wide, 2 meters long. You know, you can go down. But said, but then, if you survive the fall, then you'll be landing in sort of, you know, sometimes fundamentalist Muslim places. Then what would you do? So I already figured that one out. I'd cut a slit here. That'd be my burqa. They wouldn't know what's inside. So these robes are very practical. Many purposes. No, it's just simplicity is the main reason. May I ask, please, this is from Anne. May I ask, please, why it is seen that to find whatever, seekers often end up in Tibet or some foreign country, or end up in the forest community as opposed to seeking this in their own community? It's, again, you seek it inside your own heart and mind. The only reason for a forest, there's forests all over the world, or mountains. Actually, the word originally for it was called like an Aranya. So you have these Aranya monks. Like, no, we're Aranya monks, but it doesn't have to be a forest. It means like wilderness. And in India at that time, the only way to get away from people was go into either the mountains or mostly the forests. That's where you find some solitude. And so it doesn't have to be going into forests, even into deserts, or any place where there's few people. And that's where, in solitude, in peace, there you can get a lot of spiritual advancement, in the sense there's not much disturbance there. But to go, and where you really have to go, obviously, is not into the top of the mountain. Top of the mountain, there's too many skiers up there these days. Or there's too many mobile phone towers. Or restaurants. Mountains aren't the same as they used to be when I was a young monk. But there's a place of solitude. And you know that I often think these days, if anyone really wants to be a hermit, one of the best places of going is in the city. Like in one of these high rises. And getting a nice little small apartment there. You hardly ever see anybody. There you can actually disappear in quietness. In the middle of so many people. But you're alone. At peace, even in the middle of the city. That's actually what an Aranya is. That's what solitude is. That's what these going off to seek a quiet, peaceful time. I like thinking outside the box. Anyway, how can I establish a permanent will to meditate? My will for meditation only happens when some catastrophe happens in my life, which keeps me going for a few more days. So, of course, you can say, please have more catastrophes. No, you don't need that. The only reason why I meditate is because I enjoy it. I look forward to it. Why do people listen to their favorite music? Why do they just go to their favorite, sports tournament? Why do people do that? Because they enjoy it so much. And frankly, that's why I meditate, because I enjoy it so much. You sit there in your room, in your cave, and you just have a wonderful time. So it's never like a penance. It's the opposite. It's a joy. So if you can develop joy in your meditation, and that's why in those guided meditations, I said even when your body is relaxing, you feel delight in the body. More delightful than usual. And then when you start being in the present moment, in peace, that's so delightful. You really get into it. And it's that recognition of delight in peace, in meditation, and a mind which is free from desire, as I said a week or two ago, rather than free, so not free of desire, rather than having desire just running all over you. Those beautiful, peaceful, delightful minds are just so fantastic. You enjoy it so much, you can't get enough of it. It's beautiful. And yes, what comes up in my mind is the opening line of Endymion by John Keats. Never expected that, did you, from a Buddhist monk? It was a thing of beauty is a joy forever. And a beautiful mind is just so joyful. And peace is beautiful. That's John Keats. From Singapore next. The clergies of other religions are expected to serve, but many monks expect and demand a label to serve them. Can you please comment? Serving is not a duty, it's a joy. It's fun to serve. And like tomorrow morning, we have our breakfast. So the caretakers offer the bread, and the toaster is right next to me. You've seen this, Dorothea. How much breakfast do we have? It's just huge. But I always make sure that the toaster is right next to me, so I can serve the other monks with the toast. I am the toastmaster. But I enjoy that. You know, it doesn't matter if it's just novices with me or whatever. I just serve them toast. Make sure I make it nice. But serving other people is just so much fun. And I refuse, no matter how senior I am, I refuse to not having the privilege to serve others and be kind to them. It's wonderful to be able to have that. So it's monks expect and demand the lay people serve them. I demand that I have the opportunity to serve you. And I expect that. Because if they are expecting and for people to serve you, they're missing the point of monastic life. It's not about a self or being the top of the rung or bottom of the rung. It's just being in a wonderful sense of community. We serve one another, become at peace. And so you can be like a Buddha when you visit that monk. He never expected that junior monk to serve him. They're just meditating together peacefully. Oh, you're a good meditator. Yes, so are you. Who's your teacher? Oh, my teacher is this monk. Who's your teacher? I've got no teacher. I'm the Buddha. And that just beautiful humility was amazing to see. From the UK, do you feel if you think yourself enlightened, it means you're not? Yeah, that's true. You don't judge yourself. Am I enlightened? Am I not enlightened? Because you disappear. You don't exist. Sometimes you ask yourself, actually, who's enlightened? Isn't my body enlightened? No, this body is either going to be burnt in the crematorium or buried and eaten by all the bugs and the worms and the things which crawl in the middle of the night. Or it's going to be mulched. That's what I asked the monks to do. Put me in the recycling bin or mulch me. Why do you have to have so much ceremony around a dead body? And where am I going on this? So you're not your body, so who else are you? Is your feelings enlightened? Nah, just feelings. Is your perceptions enlightened? They're just perceptions, they change. Now we get to the interesting part. Is your will enlightened? Have you got enlightened will? If you get a deep meditation, your will stops. It's not there anymore. That can't be the enlightened one. Oh, your consciousness. Is your consciousness enlightened? No, because even that disappears and stops. There's no one left to be enlightened. Now, if you understand that, then maybe you're enlightened. Actually, you're not enlightened. You've disappeared. And enlightenment is. Does that make any sense? Probably not. If it does, then you're not enlightened. Sorry, I'm getting tired. Anyway, last question. What do I do if the world seems angry at me and I don't know how to make it better? Thank you. If you don't know how to make it better, leave it angry. What's wrong with the world being angry at you? It's actually not the world being angry, it's only a few people. Many other things in the world are not angry with you at all. You look at the birds in the sky. It's beautiful. That wonderful thing about being a monk who does, you know, live in the forest. See the kangaroos, they're just so much joy. Or in the hot weather, you see the parrots. We've got a bird bath over there. We've got a bird bath. It's supposed to be them to drink water, but they just go and jump in it and just soak themselves. And it's wonderful to see the big stupid in the bird bath. And I've never seen parrots so wet. They're soaking. But on these hot days, and I think if I was a parrot, I'd go for that. So you get so much joy and happiness. So the parrots, Bodhinyana Monastery, the kangaroos and all of those, they're not angry at you. They're just loving you and just entertaining you. You have such wonderful time. And there's so many wonderful people who come over here and this, well, they're in San Diego, fair enough. But the whole world seems angry. Do you think the people at this hall here are angry? It's wonderful that just we always say kind words to one another. So, you know, joyful words, trying to pick up people rather than put them down. See one's beautiful qualities. And when you have those ideas and those perceptions, well, there's no one angry at you at all. One of the big problems is some people are angry at themselves. That's the biggest problem. So don't be angry at yourself. Remember what I advised 2 weeks ago, if you're angry at yourself, if you don't know how to love yourself, what did I ask you to do? So over in San Diego there, if the world seems angry at you and you don't know how to make it better, then give yourself a hug, full on. You know, it actually works. Anyway. Okay, so any questions from the floor here, from people here? Yes, you have one over there. Hey, just wait for the microphone to come. There's a one. Oh, yeah, there's one at the front over there.
Standing ones?
Yeah, very good. Thank you for your question.
I wanted to ask you, if you have an obsessive thought in your mind, it's a negative thought, and it's all the time in your mind, how to get rid of it? Because it's hurting.
Okay. Remember, just be careful of wanting to get rid of it, because that will feed it and make it stronger. In other words, see if you can just put it in a bit of like a quarantine so it doesn't sort of affect other people. But wait for you, just get to know it, get to be at peace with it. It'll disappear by itself a lot of time. Remember that story of the anger-eating monster? No, okay. Okay, that's one of the classic stories here. There was an empress who came to our Buddhist society one evening, and while she was away from her palace, this big monster came into the palace. And this monster sat on the empress's chair, her throne. And all the security said, "Get out, you don't belong, you're going to get in big trouble, you're not supposed to sit, this is our empress's chair." And every unkind word, every unkind deed, unkind thoughts even, and the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more frightening. And that the guards and the soldiers, they just really got upset. And they were threatening all sorts of terrible things they're going to do to this monster. But the monster kept on getting bigger, more ugly, more frightening, and more smelly. And by the time the Empress came back from the Buddhist Society of West Australia, this monster was huge and was so frightening. It made, you know, that probably the most frightening being in the movies was Alien. It made Alien look like a little kitten, like a pussycat, like a teddy bear. And the smell, the stench coming off this monster was so bad that even the maggots crawling on the monster's skin, they threw up. Even they vomited. But the Empress, she was in that job because she was the smartest of them all. She took one look at the monster and said, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. You're not doing any harm, you're just sitting in my chair. There's other chairs I can sit in. Has anyone got you a cup of tea or something to drink? Do you want something to eat?" And she ordered one of her guards to order a pizza. They do home delivery. Monster size. They have monster size pizzas, so people tell me. And every sincere, kind word, kind act, or kind thought, the monster grew smaller. Until everybody saw their mistake. They were giving anger to this monster, so they stopped that and gave kindness. And a few of those, actually quite a few of the security, gave the monster a foot massage. It's lovely having a foot massage, Eddie. Just the monster, oh, just hear it. Oh, yeah, that's nice. But every kind act, kind thought, or kind word, just kept going smaller and smaller. And before the pizza boy came to deliver the monster-sized pizza, this demon was so small that one more act of kindness and the demon vanished completely away. And the Buddha told that story, and I added the things about the maggots throwing up and other typical Ajahn Brahm stupidities. But the Buddha told the story, and he called that an anger-eating monster. So be careful of anger-eating monsters in life. You give them anger, they get worse. Give them kindness. Thank you for coming to visit me. Things like depression are like that. Thank you for coming to visit me. And then they just get weaker and weaker and weaker. They don't pass away from you. They, at least when they stay, they're not a problem anymore. So the anger-eating monsters in life. Okay. Okay. Eddie.
Ajahn Brahm. Just now when you talk about caring and curing, you know,
yeah.
I think that's very important for all of us to consider, isn't it? Say, for example, when we face a situation, okay, whether it's mental or physical, okay, if we try to fight it, you know, in the process of fighting, you know, we go through a lot of stress, anxiety, and depression, you know. And that is going to bugger up our whole system, going to make
it's
us more...
Walk.
That's going to sort of, bugger up the system, our system, and make us more sick. You know, in that process?
Yeah, it's okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Very good.
So if you can sort of learn like, to let go, you know, and use the Buddha's tool, you know, okay?
Yeah.
That's a better way for...
Much better way.
Yeah, to fight the things, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so also, if we can let go, we can be at peace, it gives us a better chance to recover too.
Because letting go, caring, is a much softer path and very, very effective. Okie dokie, I think a few people are going out now, so I'd better... Have you got a question? No? The question is now, I can read people's minds, is can we please go now? Okay. So now we can do the chanting, and then it finishes off this evening's happy hour and a half.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadame Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sangham Namāmi.
Just to let everybody know, next Friday, Ihasapanya will be giving the talk. And hopefully she's going to come in a Santa hat, because it's Christmas Eve, Christmas Day.